And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. We have a guest today, a special guest, Gary Null, who is going to be with us. But first, let me remind everybody to check out our Facebook page. That is Occupied Territory. So you can Google Occupied Territory and Facebook. Or, since you're on PRN.fm, you can find it by going to the Occupied Territory homepage there, and that'll take you to the Facebook page. So get involved. We have discussions, essays, people post videos. We have little arguments. We have big arguments. We have agreement. It's something to get involved with. And let's see. Anything else I wanted to tell you? No, not right now. So my guest today is Gary Null, who I'm assuming needs no introduction, but we could tinker around with an introduction. He's been on the air something like 40. How many years? 40?
44
years, and with me, 33, that makes us almost 80 years on the air. So, and Gary is, of course, an author of many, many books, articles, research pieces. He is a personal speaker, large and small audiences. He is responsible for tremendous activity in alternative health over the last few decades, and most importantly for us here, he is the founder and director, I guess that's the term for it, of PRN.fm. And I know that you interview over the years. It turns out when I listen to you, you interview many of the same guests that I do, you know, when it comes especially to political or cultural things. And you've had Chris Hedges on, David Swanson, all sorts of people. It's almost like a kind of an overlapping thing sometimes. And especially since this Occupy movement, I've heard you make comments about the Occupy movement and statements. And since it started last fall, and you've had people on or you've given opinions about it, and I wanted to see if we could get some ideas from you or some feelings about what it was to begin with, why it came up, where it is now and where it's going and what its contribution is. And maybe more important than that, since the encampments came and went, they left basically a footprint or an imprint that, like, that you would look at. And it's an idea that's infiltrated into the rest of society. Not a concept that you're unfamiliar with or that anybody is who's done what we've done, but something that's getting more and more consciousness, which is income inequality, which my take on the Occupy movement is that's the main thing they injected into everything. So maybe the first question, and I have a list of questions here, we could try to perceive linearly, but since you're used to speaking at length, and so am I, and developing ideas as they pop into your head, we'll see what happens. But so the Occupy movement sort of started around last September or so, and it was originally and most visually in physical encampments, which made a tremendous impression on people, and other demonstrations at, you know, at campuses and places like that. Then the police state, to use a certain term, came in and dispersed them all, just shut them down, and sometimes violently. So first question would be is, why do you think, finally, these things sprouted in the first place?
I think that is inevitable in any society where those who are most likely to be impacted, or those around them, when there is no longer a capacity to deny or avoid the inevitable, you face it. But there's only a small segment of any population group that will actually face it. If you had 1,000 people who are incarcerated, you'll find maybe 5% who are actually articulate spokespersons for that incarcerated movement, the feminist movement, the organic movement, civil rights movement. Most people couldn't name 100 civil rights leaders, and yet there were millions of people who participated. Also, I don't believe it would happen at all had there not already have been the uprisings in Tunisia, and then a little later on in Greece. Greece preceded Tunisia, but it was not covered in the American media. But because I review about 150 different media per day, all the world media, Al Jazeera and Le Monde and Der Spiegel and BBC I'm and the Irish Times, I'm looking at every area of the world, mainly for progressive issues, not sports or local politics. I don't care about that. So already, who were these movements? These were dissatisfied and the displaced, poor, young, college students. One person in particular stood out in my mind was a 34-year-old attorney in Tunisia who had to sell fruits all day long in order to buy enough food for his family, but couldn't practice law because there was no new clients. There was no business model for him. So he had no opportunity to go forward in his life, and he joined others who found equal frustration. Now, you start looking around the world. It was inevitable what was coming to Greece, and I still think that Greece will implode in the next 2 to 3 months and throw out the people they just recently elected. And I believe the same thing will also happen in Egypt, and I believe the same thing will happen. Certainly that will happen in Spain. They just elected a very right-wing, conservative person to head, and their government is very corrupt. And there are 24% unemployment officially, and the number one mortgage company in the country has just been taken over by the government. Now, think of this. Think of the irony. A socialized republic that now has the government throwing people into the streets. That's something that will not wash under any circumstance based upon the mindset there. Now, you start looking and think, well, why did 13 nations of the world have to rebel and their students rebel before the first American rebellion? I was there on the first day. In fact, we were just watching it today when I went down to interview people. And of all the people I interviewed, and I spent the whole day there, and I interviewed probably 90% of the people who were there at Occupy Wall Street, the average person came from a privileged background. I can only find one really poor person who came up from Georgia because he heard about, you know, what would be going on there, and he felt he had a better chance of surviving there than he did down in Georgia. Mm-hmm. The woman, you see me interview several, but the first one said this: we're not about a single idea. We're about 1,000 ideas, and everybody's idea is equally valid. So don't ask me about what we're about, because we're about inequality. And so I asked her, I said, then what are you going to do to show the root of inequality and the solution to inequality? And she says, well, that's what we're here for, and we have all these congresses. And I said, what specifically are you against? She said, of inequality. How did we get inequality? Is globalization a part of it? She says, yes. I said, what part of globalization are you against? By this time, a group of other people had joined around, and they were all kind of throwing in their opinions, and all valid opinions. And as you see, I'm just standing there listening. I'm not saying anything. I just want to get a feel for what I'm dealing with. And then she said, We will have dozens of meetings around town in a week, and each and every person is equal in their capacity to share what they consider of concern to them. Mm-hmm. And she said, that's what makes us so much different than our parents' generation or any other generation.
The difference being in the form and the structure of...
Yes.
The,
yeah, okay. Yes. And I appreciated that. And I said to her, I said, everything you say, I can understand and appreciate. I said, now, how much against this are you, and are you willing to do something other than talk about it? She says, but do you understand? We talk differently than your generation. We Twitter. We Twitter constantly. Our revolution is a Twitter revolution. And I said, that's good, but show me the results, not your effort. It's the results I care about, not effort. I said, if you're really against it, will you be the example to show others there's no hypocrisy involved? Mm-hmm. She says, but we are the example. And I said, take a look at the label on my shirt, made in the USA with union labor. I said, can I see your shirt? It was made in Bangladesh. I then began to explain that the woman who made that, and it's only women, 2.5 million women, earned 14 cents an hour. They work 18-hour days. They are not allowed up except twice a day to go to the bathroom. They're monitored. They cannot talk. A man walks up and down the aisles with a switch and will smack them. They time them constantly for zippers, for pockets, how long it takes. The life expectancy, the work life expectancy of a person in Bangladesh is 32, age 32, not 32 years. When you're 32, you can't work anymore. And then I showed a picture of what it's like, because it's in my new documentary on Poverty, Inc. It's eerie. It's almost like a Fellini film. It's midnight. The streets are dark, but you hear breathing and steps. And under occasional spotlight, you'll see a mass of heads moving. These are women who cannot afford to take public transportation or private transportation, are simply walking home. They have to walk home. They have to cook the meal for the next day, do the laundry for their family for the next day, lie down and get a few moments sleep, get back up and go back to work again. 980,000 garments were made in Bangladesh last year. I opened up my wallet and I said, "Do you see I have no credit card?" I said, "I bank with a completely different system." Mm-hmm. And I said, "And I don't have a mortgage. And I eat organic. And I support local farmers. And I said, and I support unions and fair trade." I said, "Now, if you and others," because by that time a whole bunch had gotten around, and there was two guys from Rutgers University, mm-hmm. and their parents were lawyers and engineers, and this woman's parent was a teacher. So I said, "So, at the end of the day, this noble gesture that you're going through, which I support, you can go home. You're not going on the street homeless. You're not going to starve to death. You're not going to be malnourished, nor will you be denied an education or what you need. But what if you had to sacrifice and go off the grid and really be anti-Wall Street?" Because one guy was talking and it was getting very loud. And I said, "Sir, do you have money in the bank that you're out here protesting against?" "Yeah, well, that doesn't mean anything." "Well, to me and my generation, it means a great deal. You know, we went to jail rather than serve in a corrupt war." I said, "You have multiple movements that enormous sacrifice on behalf of millions of people. Some died, many died, and many suffered. Many were incarcerated because they were willing to stand up for what was right completely. Why don't you take advantage of all those lessons so you don't have to repeat them? Incorporate that which you feel is useful. Leave what you don't alone." Mm-hmm. One of the guys then said to me, and you'll see it on the film, he said, "We don't need your movements or your generation."
I've heard that.
"This is our..." And I said, "Sir, tell me something other than your ego speaking. Your generation is highly narcissistic, and unfortunately it's not your fault. I'm not blaming you. But this sense of entitlement that you are here so suddenly the revolution begins, as if none of us have ever done anything and nothing before us ever counts... Where do you think any of your freedoms of choice came from? Do you think you just woke up this morning, the world was there? There had been no history, no yesterday?" And I found that deeply concerning. And I said down that day, and you'll see it on the tape, I said, "Well," I said, "I'm going to come back every day and be here to support you. I support a lot of things I don't necessarily like. I've supported alternative cancer doctors because they could cure cancer, but they weren't nice people." Mm. All right. Lawrence Burton is one. All right. But he saved lives. And I had to put my own feelings, personal feelings aside and look for the greater good. But along the way, being there every day for the first 28 days, I was there 16 days before I could get Miss Summers and Arlene Engelhardt from Pacifica and anyone from BAI to go down there, and suddenly they discovered it.
They were way late to the game, that's true.
Way late. And then suddenly they it was like they created it, right? I said, "Use those of us in a way that will help your movement, which is our movement. We're not separate. If there's inequality, we're all involved in the effects of inequality. If there's injustice, we're all victims of injustice. This shouldn't be about the youth running a revolution and everyone else standing back as spectators in some amusement or indifference. We should all be working together." And that's how it was left that day.
Some things you're addressing there is, first of all, then they're referring partially, I think, to, well, when they say Twitter, they're referring partially to the success, I think, of social media, especially cell phones and Facebook, in the Tahrir Square in Egypt.
Yes.
You know, so technically...
And in Tunisia.
Right. So technologically speaking, there is something to that. That's almost like a separate issue. They're able to communicate faster and better in a way and show up in places in a more coordinated manner. But what you're asking then is, when you show up, what are you actually going to do besides just show up? Right?
That's correct.
What's beyond the communication and the showing up? The other thing is that... Could there be something about this this generational gap? There have been generational gaps written about since people started writing. There's always been generational gaps. And, for instance, there was a lot of, you remember this stuff from the 60s, don't trust anybody over 30. And it was basically a youth movement, mm-hmm. except, of course, the civil rights movement is the thing to look to. That was a sort of coordinated, we understand history, and we knew what you did before us.
And the feminist movement.
Yeah.
Because the leaders of the feminist movement, from Carrie Nation and Mother Jones and Susan B. Anthony,
right.
were all senior citizens when they were finally acknowledged for the goodness that they were doing.
But they were acknowledged by the modern feminist movement. They understood
Absolutely.
Whose shoulders they
yes.
were standing on, right? So are these people, are you saying that they're too disconnected, almost aggressively, narcissistically disconnected from history or from what happened before for it to be effective? That has to be taken into account, right?
I believe it's several. First, I believe that they're completely ignorant of history. I find this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but on a completely separate issue, I stood outside of Columbia University Graduate School with my camera crew, and I asked 100 graduates, students, and professors, could you please name me the 12 tipping points, and just a brief analysis of each one. No one could name two. No one. Not the professors. So we're a society that's disconnected from the world we live in when it comes to the reality of the world. We're good on headlines, terrible on text. Separately, I find that without an understanding of the progenitor, the basis upon which something is built, then we're going to be doing an awful lot of unnecessary work we don't have to. In fact, when the movement began to morph into the occupying of a space,
mm-hmm.
I felt that it would be far more powerful if they became invisible, but work behind the scenes towards boycotts. In other words, get millions of people together, for example, to boycott the interest on all student loans. Mm-hmm. Go to a given campus, like UCLA at Berkeley, which now is conservative but was liberal for 40 years, and or Columbia University, anyone. Take anyone in America, and then give out literature and information on how the Dodd-Frank Amendment was a fraud, that they cannot declare bankruptcy on their student loans, how the moment you miss a payment, you go into multiple compounding interest, late penalties, how if you've paid any of this with a debit card, you can end up paying as high as 1,500% interest on a debit card that is late. One example, I actually got the bill from a person in California who bought a pizza for $12 on a debit card, didn't pay it, then got a bill for $241 they had to pay.
And some of these people in the modern system, this is partially privatization, but some of these people get arrested and thrown in jail, like debtor's prison.
Well, there's now 27 states have debtor's prison, 27 mm-hmm. states. Not only is it that bad, but it's also that the government has now turned over for a fee the making in effect new marshals in communities, every place in America, especially poor ones.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're poor and you get a ticket, and now the person who's going to come and arrest you won't be the police, it'll be the service. And if you're on probation, the city and the state no longer handle probation. It is private companies, and they have to make a profit.
I read that the other day. I was astounded to hear about that. I mean, there's no end to this privatization.
$3,000 expense for what was originally a $100 ticket, and the $100 ticket was a false ticket to begin with. But a person ended up paying $3,000 and was taken to jail. And because they didn't have any money, they couldn't get out of jail. So what do? Every day you're in jail, they charge you.
Right.
And then that, if you don't pay that, then it compounds. They have the right to compound the interest daily.
Yeah, at least in debtor's prison in England in the 19th century, whatever it is that you were put in for, it stayed at that level until somebody paid it off. There was no interest piled on you on top of that.
Well, you realize that compounding interest, if it were just 3%,
right.
at the end of the year, you're over 1,000%. So you could be arrested for a $1,000 fee and end up paying thousands of dollars in expenses, but that's a separate issue.
Right.
But my idea was, and I shared it with him, Oliver, I said, if you get other youth who you're aligned with, who share your values, who understand your issues, who are in support of you ideologically, and you say, we're not opposed to paying the loan, that's legitimate, were opposed to paying the interest on the loan.
Mm-hmm.
And the logic was simple. And I wrote up a 27-page paper, and I gave it to them with all the references. The banks that are giving you the loan, which your parents have to sign on, they can't sign
right.
themselves, It's they're given it 0.2% interest, which is zero interest with no collateral. So Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, they're giving hundreds of billions. Right now, it's $1 trillion, $100 billion in student loans. Most of that now is interest because it clicks in the day you graduate. And then in the state of California, they sent a SWAT team, a six-member SWAT team, to arrest a woman who hadn't paid her student loan in 6 months. Any of it? She was out, but her husband and family were home, so they went through the whole home, and you're thinking, how is this possible? Now, if a person's poor, and they can't pay a student loan, and they don't have work, and they're living with their family, what good does it do to arrest them with a SWAT team and then put them in prison? Because in prison, a private corporation gets to charge money for every day you're in prison, and your family somehow is going to have to sell something to get them out of jail. So why not get all the students and say, at this university, as of today, we're refusing to pay any more interest. We are also lobbying the governor, the legislature in this state, the Board of Trustees for the university, to join with us. We're also asking the teachers union that we support in this school to join us in this protest. If they do not, then let us close down the university or school as we did in the 1960s. Remember Columbia? We closed it down. Right. And Berkeley? We closed it down. Mm-hmm. I was there. Mm-hmm. All right? Don't forget those things. And we close down the whole university until it gets attention. Now, that gets the media attention, and that gets someone coming in, the advocates who are then the Democrats, the corporate Democrats, who you actually have to embarrass to become pro-union again and do the right thing.
So that brings up the question. So here, you've mentioned a couple of things already, and we can mention 10 more things like this in terms of the inequities and the predatory nature of privatization in society and the police state. But you don't see that happening. There are individual movements like sign this petition. A lot of clicking going on. Sign this petition here, sign this petition there. There is a forgive all of student debt, not just the interest, but the principal, and start all over again. There's nationalizing the schools for veterans. But with all these things, so all of these important issues, and you're suggesting to people, this is exactly what you do, this is where you go, and then take civil disobedience a step further, do like they did, let's say, in the 60s or even in the 30s or the populist movement in this country.
Take over the campuses.
The farmers, where they block the highways, all those
block
things.
Block the highways.
Right. So, but people aren't doing that. So,
because it interferes with the truth. You see, initially when the 1%, 99% came out, it was a good metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
And I supported it. But then I said, evolve it. If you don't evolve it, it'll come back to fascia.
And what's involved in that evolution?
Well, to identify particular targets and then galvanize your energy on a particular target. If you say you're against corruption, good. Now show me someone who's corrupt. If you're against corruption in politics, someone who's been bought and sold, show me that politician and then do nonstop demonstrations against them to show the evidence.
In their offices, around their offices.
In front everything. Of their church and synagogue. When people come out, hand out flyers. Do you know who your parishioner is? Do you know what he did? Here's a list of what he did. And then use the techniques of the civil rights movement. Use the techniques of the feminist movement. Use the techniques of the of those of us who were fighting against apartheid and getting arrested down in front of the South African embassy, and picketing any corporation that was doing business, including the Israelis making arms in South Africa during apartheid, knowing full well that they were making arms to be used by the apartheid government, as was the United States, but also having other arms they were using made by an apartheid regime. And you embarrass them. You see, you're never going to beat them financially. You have to embarrass them.
Now, and that brings up another question. It brings up a lot of questions. But one is, I wonder how embarrassable, to use a certain word or to make up a word, these people are anymore. In other words, there's been, even in the 40 years since the time you're talking about, when these things occurred, when in the streets and embarrassing people. And there used to be something about the whole world is watching. Well, now the whole world is watching, and so what? The whole world has a lot to watch. You know
what
I mean?
Hold on. Yeah. Embarrassing is only the first step. There's a reason to embarrass them. First step is you have to prove that you have a person who's just an immoral, unethical person.
But what if
you ask people to boycott them? Look at Rush Limbaugh. He was first embarrassed. Then, after he was embarrassed, he was boycotted. He lost over 180 sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
That cost him almost $200 million in income. He hasn't filled those blanks yet.
Right.
All right? So that's how we do it. Now, right now, let me just give you an example of how it works. And this is one of those ironies. We led about 8,000 members of my radio audience as a part of a larger group, a grassroots support, a group with Jeffrey Smith and Vandana Shiva, to highlight what's wrong with genetic engineering. Mm-hmm. Now, we weren't saying ban genetic engineering. We were saying label it. So if you want to eat it, it's there. Because we knew that the industry is too big and has too much control to ban.
And they're constantly fighting the idea of labeling it.
So. That's correct. Yeah. But labeling is something else. Because then you would have them go out of business if people knew it was genetic. No, 90% of the public said they're not going to buy anything if it's genetically engineered, if they know it.
Mm-hmm.
So now, here in New York in Prospect Park, we had all these booths and tables and great speakers. The guy from Consumer Report was there. So, and the guy, Dr. Broner, who helped contribute and finance this, good for him. Anyhow, we did it in a very organized way. Education, giving out literature. We had, I think, 12 speakers. And there was music. There were booths. Then it began a march of 14 days to Washington, D.C., stopping at every community pre-planned to educate the public, ending up in Lafayette Park across the White House. So I couldn't join every day in the march.
Right.
I was there. My audience was 90% of them. But I got my camera crew down there, and we went down to film it. And instead of being a speaker down there, I much prefer just to do the filming. So there I am in front of the White House, filming the speakers and filming people's views on genetic engineering. And it was a humongous group. We had our permits. It was well organized. But one block away, just one block up from Lafayette Park, there's two small parks, little tiny parks, less than a half a block in size, enough for about 200 people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, indeed, both of them had about 200 people, and they had little pup tents. And so I went up there, and I started to speak with people. And the first two women I came to were in a tent, and they had their kids. And how long have you been here? We've been here 4 weeks. And what do you do? We're both school teachers. And I said, it's great. We're here to support you. It was Occupy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, would you be interested in coming and speaking with our group? And we'll ask all the thousands of people who are there to come up and give you support. What's your group? We're opposed to genetic engineering, and we want to get it labeled, so we're here to talk about the dangers of genetic engineering. Not interested. I said, all right. Would you like us to come up here and give you some support? We have a lot of food.
Mm-hmm.
No, we're fine.
And so what is happening there?
They felt that any other movement, I talked about nuclear, weren't interested. Vaccination, not interested. If it's not their specific issue that they're interested in, they're disconnecting from everything else. But I thought, okay, you know, maybe it's just these two people. I even said we have some blankets and things from the 14 days. People are going to go home today. Can we donate these? We got plenty. I went to every single person in the park. Now I got interested in this. So I had my camera rolling, right? And they were having a little assembly. What do you want? I'm here filming. So, well, we don't want to be filmed. I said, but I can take your message to a larger audience.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need a large audience. Okay. So then I went to every single person, as you'll see in the park. Not one of them wanted to come down to what we were doing to see about genetic engineering and anti-nuclear we were combining to, nor were they interested in our help. Now, 90% of these people were young people, and I, two of the people who had come from Los Angeles and one from San Francisco, clear across America, because it all started out in the West Coast, came across, stopping in different cities before it got to New York and then to mm-hmm. Washington, culminating there. They said, wow, man, this is not the image I'm getting on television when I see these people. And a woman named Bev, who helped organize all this, she turned to me and she said, I hope they don't make this whole movement about occupying a little piece of land, because that's what the media and their critics will turn it into.
And that's what they did.
That's exactly what they did. And that's what I was telling them. Please, for the sake of your movement, because you know what the government can't control and big corporations can't control? They can't control if like in a true anonymous situation, they went invisible and did their work behind the scenes with their Twittering, focusing. Let's say you got 100 issues that are important. Start with issue one and say, we're all going to work on issue one for 3 months, then issue two for 3 months, issue three for 3 months. Now, in a period of 2 years, you've gone through an awful lot of issues, all the important ones certainly in some priority, but you've galvanized people's interest. So then when I went back recently, and I was speaking with someone on the Occupy movement who had been there, and I said, think of the lessons you could have learned, but you chose not to. That's called hubris.
Which are the lessons?
The lessons is work together for a common good.
Join a large.
Right. Because that's how you get people who are politically active. Get people who are articulate spokespersons and have the background and credentials that they can speak on your behalf. What do you mean? Let me give an example.
There's something I ran into with trouble. We have no leader. We have no spokesperson. We're completely horizontal.
Well, fine. And then you end up horizontal in the world's consciousness.
And the horizontal is also where you wind up finally at the end of your life, and they put 6 feet of dirt.
Well, just keep in mind, there's an old Italian saying, the king and the peasant both go in the same ground. You have to understand that without some organizational principles of movements, you're not going to go forward.
But some of those are inevitably, they were with the civil rights movement, hierarchical. They have to be.
You have to have that.
But this is something that I run into all the time with. So, you know, I sort of finally gave up on interviewing the activists, and then the activists kind of disappeared because the camps were shut down. Now I concentrate on the ideas and interview people about the ideas and what they're doing about it in local places, like in, you know, West Virginia. You know?
It'll come back. It'll come back, but not with the same people and not for the same reason.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a point of a perfect storm. Let me just give you one example, and this is what I told to a group of them in Washington. I said, we have 104 nuclear power plants in the United States. They're all unsafe. We have one that's just 28 miles north of Manhattan, Indian Point. There's two reactors. First, they take 4 billion gallons, 2 billion each a day, every day, of water out of the Hudson, killing over, I think it was 100 million fish a year, to cool the reactors. If that reactor should go out for any reason, like a solar storm that's coming, or maybe an earthquake, which we've had, or some dysfunction or terrorist attack, you've got 5 days of backup support fuel. That's it. In fact, every single nuclear facility, including in Oak Ridge, only in Los Alamos, only has 5 days of backup fuel. What happens after that is then you go into a complete meltdown, and you have Fukushima's. You won't see it. You won't hear about it. You won't hear an explosion. You'll notice in the kids when you start seeing blood coming out of their nose and their eyes and their ears. By that time, they had a lethal dose of radiation poisoning. There's nothing anyone in the world can do to help them. Others, depending upon how long you're exposed and what level radiation's hitting you, within 10 days of a complete meltdown at Indian Point, New York City will never be habitable ever in history again. In the history of this world, no one will ever be able to come. But more so, you're going to kill 20 million people. Now, I said, isn't that worth paying attention to? That's very important. Well, here's what we did. We got together the best minds on the subject, of which there are about 20. That's it. But I'm talking about Michio Kaku and Helen Caldicott and Harvey Wasserman and Carl Grossman. Really good, and Vandana Shiva and Greg Palast and others. We put them all together. We did a documentary, did a series of articles, got all their articles, got their documentaries, and made one formidable presentation. Then we did a demonstration in front of the governor's office, and legislators showed up. Then we did presentations, legislators showed up. Then we had a demonstration in front of Indian Point. And so many people showed up, thousands showed up, and the media showed up. Now, the public who wants to has a point of view. We have a place they can go and read every article, calls to action, and we're constantly hammering the legislators in New York State and the governor, don't allow this plant to stay open. Now, slowly but surely, we are gaining strength. More and more people are aware. Now, other cities across the country are using the example in New York of what we did here, and they're using in Diablo Canyon and all in Los Angeles and all these other places with 104 other nuclear facilities. The activists are using. These are grassroots activists. And I So now we actually have something that's happening. Just like, you know, that march on Washington we did? Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Now there's a grassroots effort, and our KPFK audience, I've been on there 29 years, 6 hours every Wednesday, we have 1 million signatures to get labeling of genetically engineered food on the ballot in a referendum in November. So now we're rushing to finish, in the other room, we're rushing to finish Seeds of Deception, the truth about genetically engineered foods. And my opening scene is, you see a man being given a paper. And the paper is the notice that his farm no longer belongs to him. Now, in India, unlike the United States, where here if someone's going to take away your property, you can go to court, and there you can't. Mm-hmm. Because when you take out a micro loan or a macro loan, these are private lenders that give it to you. You must sign over the deed to your property. They give you a specific date. You must pay it back. On that date, if you do not have the money in full, they take your property. You are virtually homeless. You don't. You can't take any equipment, nothing, animals. Whatever you lose everything. On that date, the man and his family standing by gets the notice, walks slowly out into his cotton field, sits down, prays, and then drinks a quart of the pesticide from Monsanto, and over the next 35 minutes you watch him die. That's the opening of the film, True Situation. Now, how many more? 257,000 farmers in India alone have killed themselves just this way. And then you follow it through, and you talk with the people who know they're going to kill themselves because there's no other way they can support their family. And you think, well, that's kind of stupid, because if you kill yourself, then how's your family supposed to support themselves? In any case, I open with this shot of Monsanto's spokespersons all praising genetic engineering and how great it is. And then I show you this ritual where, gee whiz, the genetic engineering of Monsanto's cotton didn't help these people. Then I go into the politics of it. That galvanizes people. Now we have a referendum. Now, the referendum in California, supported by Monsanto's deceit, I believe will get us that voted. So the first state in the United States to, by law, say that if you sell any product in this state, including in a restaurant, it must be labeled. Now Vermont and Connecticut and New York, we have grassroots everywhere doing this.
So let me ask you a question about this. This is another thing about the Occupy movement. And a lot of people have said this. You talk to Hedges and other people and who are knowledgeable about movements and the way things work, and they talk about populist movements. Anything that ever, and when you mentioned civil rights earlier, right, anything it seems to me that ever sort of changed the way this country was, and even in the 30s when the Roosevelt administration had to put these new things into play, it was because you had a million people parading in the streets. People joined the Communist Party. There were almost uprisings. It seems to me, and the Occupy movement is saying this, but I don't know how it's playing out. You used the magic words in your discourse. You said, at one point, you said ballot. Another point, you say referendum. It seems to me that if you work within the electoral system, which is almost 99%, to use a certain phrase, owned by the corporations. I mean, I don't know how much they always owned the government. They used to appoint senators directly from the state senate who were actually on the floor of the state senate. They were handing people money. They were auctioning off senate seats. Okay, it seems to me, it may be not true, but it seems to me that the corporations own the government and the legislators and the president and probably the Supreme Court.
But they don't own the process. What they own is the most vulnerable people who are willing to give up their integrity to vote in a particular way. We're talking about getting referendums where the politician isn't going to decide anything.
But there are states where there aren't where the public doesn't have a referendum capacity. New York State doesn't have much of that, for instance.
But we could. All states could. Just like all states like North Dakota,
but
and
the
Montana
legislatures
could have a state bank.
But the legislatures and the executive would actually have to sign that into law, right?
So but that's correct. But that's why you have to start running candidates that are third-party candidates.
Ah, here we go.
That vow not to, like Rocky Anderson and Jill Stein and others of integrity who vowed up front, I'm not going to, and have set a platform, and they put it in writing. For example, I had Jill Stein, Rocky Anderson, and Gary Johnson on, and Ralph Nader and Dennis Kucinich were, it was 3 hours, and they were, two were on the program preceding me, and then the three were on mine, and I went through 30 important issues. Will you close the Federal Reserve and give the right to print money only to the U.S. Treasury at zero interest? Yes. Will you close all military bases of the United States around the world? Yes. Will you close down the embassy in Iraq and withdraw all private contractors, cancel all contracts, and stop all military? Yes. Will you? And then I went through all
these. The drone use.
Yes. Will you provide for a single payer? Yes. Will you repeal the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security Act? Will you close down 14 of the 16 intelligence agencies? Yes. Will you go back and hold accountable all people who have committed any crime under any former administration? Will you hold them accountable, crimes against humanity today, if they are found guilty? Yes. So only one person dissented out of 30 questions from all being unified. So my question to them is, why don't you all unify?
You know, I've had Rocky Anderson on my show several times. By the way, for people who are listening, Rocky Anderson is the former mayor of Salt Lake City, and he is running on something called the Justice Party. And I think you could go to voterocky.org. I've had Jill Stein on. I've had Rocky Anderson on. Next thing I'm going to do is have them on both at the same time, because the last time Rocky Anderson was on, I said, why don't you and Jill get together? Because that's the way things work, unity, right? And he gave me a long, rambling answer, but it almost sounded as if, and I'm just interpreting here, that somebody wanted to be on top and nobody wanted to agree who that was going to
be. Well, that's really safe sex, all right, where everyone's on top. What we have here is I spoke with Ralph Nader.
Is that really safe?
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe
just
frustrating.
To get a few other things. All right.
I spoke with Jesse Ventura. I spoke with Ralph Nader. Spoke with Dennis Kucinich, Jill Stein, Gary Anderson, Rocky Anderson. Six people. There are more. But six people who have very common ideas. Common enough that they could work together. And I said, let this cycle go. Get the chaos out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
All right, get the egos out of the way. And then have one party, the People's Party. Because, yes, there's only going to be one president, one vice president, but you've got a Secretary of State, you've got a Secretary of Commerce, Secretary of the Treasury. And I said, think what good you could do.
But what's the response to that when you win?
I got positive response from everyone. Positive from everyone.
And yet, at this moment, while we're talking, there are still separate tickets.
They can't change. They can't put the brakes on something they've been accelerating that's uniquely their own. But after they all fail, and fail miserably,
mm-hmm.
with probably cumulatively 4% of the vote amongst all of them, and the highest will be Gary Johnson, Rocky Anderson will be less than 1%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think of Ross Perot had 22% and didn't get him anything, but and there was nothing happened thereafter. But he was the progenitor for this. So once they all get this out of their system, and then you look at what could be done, then it's about bringing people together. And that's what I'm trying to do all the time, bring people together through a common coalition.
Okay, here's another question you just arrived at two-thirds of the way down my question sheet. Okay, so we're moving along rapidly here. The next big question is, we've covered the structure, the form, the horizontalism, the not building on history. We've covered third party, the electoral system. You just mentioned the other thing. Now, you're suggesting these people get together, and you constantly be talking about, and then I did this, and we brought these people together. And when you say we, sometimes you mean I. I don't really ever remember a movement like in India with Gandhi, or the civil rights movement with somebody who like Martin Luther King, and even the anti-war movement had a few people who were articulate and in charge. Can you have a movement without a charismatic, dedicated leader to bring people together?
No. I wish it were otherwise. I'd love to say that this whole concept, but I don't believe you can do it with one. I believe you have to have at least 20 to 30 charismatics. I believe there are thousands of charismatics. I just believe that it, you know what I see, and I see it on Progressive Radio Network. You'll hear people that you've never seen before, heard before anywhere, because we go out of our way to find them. And then people email, gee, that was a phenomenal discussion that guy had, or that woman, to give us such insight. Why haven't we heard from him? Because what you've heard up to this point, historically, is you've heard people maladapt themselves based upon the form they've been given.
Mm-hmm.
I was on ABC for 12 years. I was on WBD for almost 14 years. I've been on WBA for 29 years and 6 months, Pacifica for 35 years. It's always maladapting, meaning you're given a form, but you're given very careful guidelines. You got to stay within. And if you look at the left has become a corporatized left. And if it decides to become independent and challenge, it's suddenly excluded. That person no longer is given any invitations to speak, and the same on the right.
When you say corporatized, you don't mean literal. You don't mean corporations like the Bank of America. You mean the form of a corporate, the structure.
That is correct. Yeah. Those who know, just like MSNBC.
Right.
You have not seen Rachel Maddow and Ed Scholz.
Oh, tell me that.
All right, and Keith Olbermann. You have not seen them, A, out there leading demonstrations where they risk getting themselves in jail, B, doing something that otherwise they say, well, conspiracy nuts. We've done some very serious programs on legitimate conspiracies.
But even at a place like my former radio station, WBAI, or even Pacifica, you know better than anybody, and I know myself, you can get frozen out in the cold pretty quick for not carrying the party line. In a place
they do it already.
Yeah.
The only reason I'm on BAI in Pacifica is because I bring them money.
Right.
I get never a penny, even though I'm supposed to, never a single penny. I brought them, ready for this? $43 million. But more importantly, I brought them about 60,000 audience. When I went on there, there were 300 people listening per quarter hour. Today, according to the latest Arbitrons, their morning show, which should be the strongest, 400 listeners. How in the world? They've lost about 85% of their audience from last year alone.
This is a whole other discussion we can have. You and I know how people are chosen to get airtime there. That's a different story. So basically, I want to get back to that.
But the audience is not a progressive audience.
These are the kind of liberals that Chris Hedges talks about.
These are the type of liberals who be very careful, because these are very connected ideologically and frequently financially to a concept that you do not challenge them. You challenge them, you're out. All right? So that's why I founded Progressive Radio Network. Now, here's some numbers that might interest you. The number of people calling in on a phone number who want to listen. We just hit almost a million minutes and over 58,000 people using the telephone. That's more than the entire audience of BAI. We now have almost 6,000 brand new listeners a day, every day, to Progressive Radio Network. Those are true progressives. People are not ideologically aligned, but rather interested in the truth wherever it comes from, willing to work to see that something has changed for the betterment of all people.
And maybe to cross-pollinate, where people will have other people on their shows.
That's correct. That's where all these people, because the guests we're having on, we're never invited on any other program. All right? You would really risk your show bringing a Chris Hedges on. You know,
I've had Ted Rahl on my show. You know Ted Rahl?
Sure.
I've had Ted Rahl on my show basically violating the McCarran Act of 1940.
Yeah.
But with having a conversation on the radio about how to overthrow the government of the United States. I said, you understand, you just broke the federal law. He said, yeah, well, let's continue the conversation. You know, it's difficult. It's difficult to get. And you bring up MSNBC, man, that is a pet peeve of mine. I watch those people. My wife says, oh, are we going to watch Rachel Maddow? Are we going to watch Ed Scholz? I said, no, I'm sick of it. All I see is people being paid five. You know, God bless them if they want to make a lot of money. They get paid $5 million to $8 million a year. Maybe Scholz, sometimes he showed up in Madison, which I applauded. I like the way that Ed Scholz showed up in Madison, you know, put his body
on. Yeah, he did.
Okay.
That's
but the
good.
Rest of them, I don't hear one word out of them about anything the Obama administration does in terms
Nothing.
Of national security, about violating the Constitution, about surveillance, about Guantanamo, about drones. Not one damn word, and I'm forced to conclude they are the liberal spokespeople for the Democratic Party.
They are.
You know. And
they
it's
are.
A shame. It's a shame because they are effective people. They're intelligent people. They have huge audiences. And you just want to grab them by the throat and say, look, bring these other people on. Say the right
they
thing.
They can't do that.
Well, you see the commercials that come on right after them?
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Same commercials that come on after every other show.
Yes. So. Look, they're very smart. These are very bright people.
They are. And I think their hearts are in the right place sometimes.
Well, sometimes, but there's no real follow through, and you don't see the people that could challenge them invited on.
Well, that's true. It's funny you mention that, because I remember right after Obama got elected, the first person Rachel Maddow had on, or the second person, was Jonathan Turley, who is a law professor at George Washington University.
Yes.
She says, what's the first thing he needs to do? He says, angry in a passionate way. He looks at the camera, he says, we've got to indict Bush, we've got to indict Cheney. We have to, and the reason to do this is to set democracy itself back on its foundations so that people know that there really is law in this country. He said, if we don't indict these people, we'll set a precedent. And I've never seen him back on that show. You know what I mean?
When you realize how far you can go in a career by being a corporate Democrat, when you look at the Clintons and the Obamas, and you can go a long way. Every door is going to open for you. You challenge that, and suddenly you're no longer a corporate Democrat. You're one of those wild conspiratorial liberals. The same is true on the right. And yet you start looking at the truth, and you see where the truth is, and neither the corporate left or right are on mark. So the idea is that I believe that we're in a great place. I'm very optimistic. I believe that if we can learn the lessons of all the movements that fail or partially succeed, and we bring people together, and each movement has articulate spokespersons. I'm a big believer in having between 5 and 20 different people who can speak on behalf of a movement. So you never want a movement with just one person.
You don't want to concentrate the message or the power into
because look, if you got 20 people writing on something, talking on something, then you're getting diversity.
But there's a fine line then between diversity. There's a line you cross somewhere between diversity and fragmentation, right?
But if you're all against nuclear,
right?
And you
so
all,
if the basic principles are agreed on.
As long as you come together and you're reading each other's articles, you know the scholarship each person put into it. These are people are not going to be compromised. These are people with high level of integrity, and these are people who are going to win every debate they're in.
Well, a person who I've had on many times on my show, this show and on Sirius, is Kevin Zeese, who always impresses me.
Yes.
I mean, this man's been at it for 40 years now, his whole adult life.
I agree.
Normal, you know, everything. Well, let me ask you one last question, because time, you know how fast time goes on the radio. You know. Here's a system. We're talking about corporate control. Basically, we're looking at a fascist state. And I'm not throwing that word around easily.
It is fascist.
Okay. So the combination of corporate or rich people's control and police power, you have a fascist state. And we have one. We're looking at one right now in our own country. So you have all this stuff on there. And people talk about maybe the only way to deal with this is to – I've had Les Leopold on, who's a favorite guest of mine, an economist. He talks about this Robin Hood tax, you know, right? Put a transaction tax on everything Wall Street does. I don't see why we should ask the pirates to contribute maybe a few pieces of gold and let them continue to be pirates. Here's my question without making a speech. Is it possible to have capitalism and democracy? I mean, Brandeis said it wasn't. Let me be straight ahead with you right here. This station wouldn't exist unless in some way you thrived by inside a capitalist system, because you created this station, and not for nothing. You had to pay out a lot, and it cost you a lot to do this, right?
About $3 million.
So that $3 million didn't come from nowhere. It came because
from came from my best-selling books and all my lecture fees. I contributed.
All right. What I'm saying is, can you have a country where the banks are not nationalized, where the energy companies are not nationalized? Do you need a socialist economy?
You do not. All you need is redefining capitalism as fair exchange. Last year, $12 billion was exchanged in barters and people who did not have the money to buy something.
I should say we only have about a minute left.
Okay. So, yeah. I believe in what is known as an ethical exchange. If you start off with what is each person contributing, whether it's publishing or broadcasting or a clothes store or a health food store. I have a health food store that's successful because I chose to take no money out of it. Instead, the money that would go there goes to the employees at the end of the year as a bonus for them to share and for helping people who are homeless or don't have food. So making the money is not the issue. How you as an individual choose to spend it is the issue. And we simply need more morally based, ethical, humanistic, and spiritually evolved people to show by example how you can do things without thinking of your own needs and excessive accumulations first.
So it's a collective rededication, which I don't see happening in the media or education. I don't know where people are going to learn this new spirituality or this reclaiming of old-fashioned, decent spirituality. Where are they going to learn this?
Through normal interrelationships and listening to programs. Look, we've never had an article, and yet we'll have 101.5 million new downloads and over 1.5 million new listeners. That's new listeners in the next 12 months based upon our current trajectory. It's all about listening and associating.
So this station is a living embodiment of what you're talking about.
Well, right? We've had thousands of people come on the air and share their thoughts with millions of people. So this is how it happens under the radar. Remember, when you're invisible, you have more power than when you're not.
Well, this is visible. I mean, it's not visible, but people can hear this.
It's invisible to the mainstream.
Oh, okay.
Hence, we're not a threat to the mainstream.
All right, we've got,
okay. Thanks for the opportunity to
Gary,
with
I
you.
Really appreciate you coming on today.
All the best.
Okay, this is Occupied Territory. You were listening to Gary Null as my guest today. Tune in next week. We're going to have somebody on who is an expert from the Brennan Center talking about Citizens United and how it could be defeated state by state, maybe a constitutional amendment. And I'll be on next on Monday with The Turning Point, Monday at 4 o'clock. Thanks again to Gary Null. Take it away.